So, hello again. I'm on page 32, cell respiration. Let's finish topic 2, okay? Cell respiration and photosynthesis. These are the two topics that I'd like to talk about now. So, page 32, top box, cell respiration, cell energy and cells. What is cell respiration? A short definition. Well, cell respiration is the controlled release of energy from organic compounds. And what the cells do is they produce ATP. And now ATP carries this energy from the organic compounds. What are the organic compounds? Well, organic compounds, these are the foods that we eat, okay? And we're going to talk specifically about glucose. But of course, this also includes proteins and lipids and fats and so on, okay? But what happens to these substances is that they are broken down by the cells, and they're converted to carbon dioxide, of course, but their energy is caught and captured and stored in ATP. Why is that? Because the ATP, that is the molecule that can now be used by the different parts of the cell as an energy source. You see, glucose and lipids and carbohydrates and so on, they store energy, of course, but for example, a membrane pump, which pumps ions across, cannot directly use the glucose. It needs ATP. So we first have to convert the energy into a usable form for the cell. And this usable form is ATP. Now, having said that, sometimes there's a little confusion here because a cell respiration sometimes might be confused with the respiratory system or the ventilation system, the lungs, okay? But that has nothing to do with that. Cell respiration is a chemical process. It's a metabolic process. In which glucose and other organic substances are broken down to release their energy in the form of ATP. Okay, so that is the important thing here. A definition is important. Okay, now the thing is in the next box, aerobic and anaerobic cell respiration. There are these two forms that we exist in nature: aerobic and anaerobic cell respiration. And I'm just going to give you now a comparison of both of them. First of all, aerobic and anaerobic. The most important distinction is whether oxygen is required or not. In aerobic, that is, of course, oxygen is required. That's why it's called aerobic. And in anaerobic, oxygen is not required. So that is kind of the name-giving criterion here. And a second difference is what substrate is used. So basically, what organic substances are broken down? In aerobic respiration, glucose or lipids can be broken down. And in anaerobic respiration, only glucose. So that is a second distinguishing characteristic. I think maybe not the most important one, okay? But another important one is now the yield of ATP per glucose. So if you take a molecule of glucose, how much ATP can you produce? How much energy can you release? And in aerobic cell respiration, you produce a very large amount of ATP, while in anaerobic, a very small one. So I think, in my view, that these are the two important things. So the advantage of aerobic respiration is that it produces a large amount of ATP. The disadvantage, so to say, is that you need oxygen. Okay. And what are the end products formed? In aerobic respiration, carbon dioxide and water. So the glucose that we started out with is converted to carbon dioxide, and which is then exhaled and breathed out. Okay. And in anaerobic respiration, humans produce lactate or lactic acid, which then builds up in the muscles. Okay, for example, when you're running a lot, very quickly, then your muscles start to hurt, and this is because your muscles have become anaerobic, and they started to produce lactate, which then builds up in your muscles. And only if you stop running, and if you get enough oxygen again, only then the lactate is broken down again and converted back. And in yeast, carbon dioxide and ethanol is made. And that is also known as alcoholic fermentation, because ethanol, that is the alcohol that is used in alcoholic beverages. Okay, so these are the important differences. The name-giving difference is whether oxygen is used or needed or not. And another important one is the amount of ATP produced. Okay, these are the two really important ones. I'm now going to step you through the aerobic and anaerobic respiration a little bit, the standard level way. Higher level people have to know much more, and there's a separate chapter, whole chapter simply dedicated to that. However, I think it would be good to redraw this a little bit, because I think the drawings that we have in the book here in this box are a little bit confusing. Okay, some of the things can stay the same, but other things are a little bit confusing here. So what we do is the following. We start off with glucose, and that is fine. And we convert the glucose to a substance called pyruvate. This step produces a small amount of ATP. So the glucose is broken down. It's split into two parts to produce pyruvate. And in this process, we make a small amount of ATP. And this first step is called glycolysis. It's not labeled in the book, but it's called glycolysis. And from this pyruvate, that's an important intermediate compound, we now have two possibilities. We can go aerobic or we can go anaerobic. It's a little bit confusing here in the book, okay? In the aerobic pathway, what we do is we continue and we go from the pyruvate and we produce carbon dioxide, water, and large amounts of ATP. Okay, so that is theoretically what you could do is you could draw an arrow from pyruvate and to carbon dioxide plus water plus ATP, large amounts of ATP. Okay, so it's completely broken down. The glucose is gone. Okay, we've converted the glucose into carbon dioxide. Okay, so that's aerobic respiration. And in this process, from pyruvate to carbon dioxide, water, and large amount of ATP, you might add here that you need oxygen. Okay, so you might want to draw an O2, and you might want to draw the O2 that goes into the arrow. Okay, oxygen is required. And that is aerobic respiration. Okay, and now what about the anaerobic respiration? What you do is you go from the pyruvate, you draw another arrow away to lactate, okay? And then you write small and plus small amounts of ATP produced, okay? So what we have is that's it, and we're finished, okay? Lactate and small amounts of ATP, and then open parenthesis in humans, close parenthesis, or ethanol and CO2 in open parenthesis yeast, close parenthesis. So we have two possibilities here. Okay, so again, to summarize this, because I've dictated now to you the whole process, and we go from glucose, and we draw an arrow to pyruvate, and we produce a small amount of ATP. That's what we have in the book. And at the pyruvate, we have two arrows going away, so to say. One arrow is the aerobic pathway, where we convert the pyruvate to carbon dioxide, water, and large amounts of ATP. And the other arrow going away from pyruvate is the anaerobic pathway, which goes to lactate in humans and CO2 and ethanol in yeast, okay? And if you already have this, and then if you have this drawing, then you already know many of the differences, okay? You know whether you've needed oxygen or not, because I hope that you labeled that you need oxygen for aerobic. You added oxygen in the aerobic arrow, okay? We know that glucose starts at the beginning in both, but for the aerobic one, we can also start off with lipids. And the amount of ATP produced is also very large in the aerobic and small in anaerobic. We've got that. And also the products formed, CO2 and water, lactate, CO2 and ethanol in anaerobic, and CO2 and water in aerobic. Well, we've also got this in the diagram. So I think in my view is if you just remember this diagram and study this diagram, then you already also know many of the parts of the comparison table between aerobic and anaerobic cell respiration. Okay, so that was basically, this completes this box over here. In the next box, energy for muscles, the box on the right side, it is like this, that in sports, anaerobic cell respiration plays a very important part because it is able to provide the muscles with ATP very quickly. The disadvantage, of course, as I mentioned, the amount of ATP is not very much. So for about 2 minutes, the muscles can be anaerobic, and this releases ATP very, very quickly. The reason being that the muscles now do not depend on your lungs and on the circulatory system to supply it with oxygen. So in other words, what the muscles say is the following: who cares about the oxygen supply? I mean, they're the heart and the lungs, they're and the circulatory, they're too slow in giving me oxygen, you know. You know what, I'm just gonna go anaerobic, and I quickly have for 2 minutes ATP. Okay, so that is kind of the one of the advantages of anaerobic cell respiration in muscles. Okay, disadvantage, of course, not a lot of ATP, but we get it quickly. Okay, and that is explained over here in the box. In the process, the muscles, of course, make lactate, which builds up in the muscles. okay? And then later on, if you continue doing this over 2 minutes, then your muscles become more and more acidic, okay? And that means that it's then going to be then, this also reduces then the cell respiration again. Okay, so for a short time, it is possible to go anaerobic in your muscles, and this supplies ATP very quickly. Another example, if you, for example, want to run a marathon for 2 hours, over 2 hours, okay, then of course you want to stay aerobic all the time. You want to stay aerobic all the time. So you're not allowed to run too quickly. That's important, because if you run too quickly, you're going to go anaerobic and you're going to lose energy. But if you pace yourself, if you go slow enough, then you always to make sure that you must stay aerobic. By the way, there's a sport called aerobics, right? Then you will have, you won't get tired as quickly, okay? So next box, using yeast in brewing and baking. What you do is you take yeast and you mix it into dough to make bread. Now, and then if you wait in about an hour, then the carbon dioxide in that the yeast produces will start to leaven, to raise the dough, okay, to rise, okay? And this means this is responsible for the little holes in the bread, right? And this is by anaerobic respiration, okay? First of all, the yeast uses up all of the oxygen in the dough, then it goes anaerobic. It will start to make a lot of CO2 and ethanol, and this will basically leaven the dough. If you say ethanol, well, why does bread not contain alcohol? Well, because during the baking process, the alcohol again is removed that the yeast makes, okay? So that is number one. You may use yeast in breaking baking bread, and this this is done by anaerobic respiration. The second one is you see in the drawing over here on page 32, a fermenter, and that is for making alcohol. What you do is you take the yeast and you add sugar or for example the grape juice or so, and then the grape juice is converted to wine, because the yeast will take the sugar to convert it to alcohol and CO2, okay? And that's why you have to make sure that the CO2 is able to escape, okay? And the yeast then later on has to be removed, of course, and there are different ways of how this is done. And sometimes it's not removed. There are certain beers around that still contain the yeast. So these are the beer looks kind of cloudy and is turbid, okay? It's not clear. And the reason being is there is still the yeast in there, okay? So that is, these are two different ways how it is made. Of course, the alcohol that is made by the brewing process sooner or later will also start killing the yeast, of course. So the maximum level of alcohol that you can make this way is also also limited, okay? So that is also a way of how you make ethanol for gasoline or for fuel, okay? It's by fermenting. One of the things is that you that some of the yeasts are, you just add, if you have a lot of carbohydrates and you add it, it doesn't even have to be high quality, it will start to ferment the whole thing and it will start to make the ethanol, which you can then distill out. Okay, page 33, I'm on the next page, respirometers. That's an experimental page here, and what I'm going to do right now is I'm going to explain you the drawing, the experiment in the box, respirometers and respiration rates. How can you measure cell respiration? And I tell you what we could do is we could measure how much oxygen is used up, okay, by a certain organism. And then we can try to measure the volume of gas that is kind of, we now use up the oxygen, so the volume of the gas should go down, right? Because we're using up oxygen. But the problem is that the organisms make CO2, okay? So it kind of equalizes out the loss of gas, okay? So we don't see a change in the volume of gas produced, because for the oxygen, we use up the oxygen, but we're producing CO2, so there is no change, right? So what we have to do is what a solution would be is okay, the insects or whatever animals we use, they use up oxygen, they produce CO2, that's fine, but this CO2 is immediately taken away, okay, and is removed. And if this happens, then the overall volume of gas goes down. And that's basically the point of this experiment. We're taking away the CO2 that the insects form, and therefore, the volume of gas inside the test tube goes down. So how do we do that? Inside the test tube, you will see that there is potassium hydroxide solution, and this solution takes up and removes the carbon dioxide. so therefore decreasing the volume of gas inside the test tube. There is a filter paper rolled to form a wick, a little filter paper. The reason why they have this filter paper is because it soaks up with the potassium hydroxide solution and simply increases the surface area to absorb carbon dioxide. That's really the only point here, okay? And then we have a wire basket here in the test tube, which contains the invertebrates, the insects, or seeds, because seeds, when they germinate, they use up oxygen and produce CO2. They don't do any photosynthesis yet. We don't have any leaves yet. They only do cell respiration. And we have a graduated 1 cubic centimeter syringe to add more of the potassium hydroxide solution, okay? Or to kind of compensate the manometer, which you can find on the left side. And now if the seeds or the insects, if they use up oxygen, produce CO2, the CO2 is removed by this potassium hydroxide. This lowers the pressure of the gas inside the test tube, and therefore the water on the left side in this water bath, there is a little tube in there going in there, and you can see that it's filled with water. And this one is then going to be sucked more and more towards the test tube. But the whole thing also is kept in a water bath to keep it at a constant temperature so that the pressure does not change because of temperature changes. Let's move to the next box, ethical implications. And here they talk a little bit about animal experiments when you use them in respirometers. A few questions that you should ask yourself. There are four of them here. Ask yourself, do the animals, will they suffer any pain or any harm during the experiment? Number two, are there any unacceptable risks to the organisms? For example, if they come in touch with the potassium hydroxide, is this going to hurt them somehow? Number three is you are removing organisms from the natural habitat, natural environment, and is it possible for you to return them? And number four, are animal experiments really necessary in the first place? Because those respirometer experiments, they can also be done with germinating seeds. And these are plants, of course, and maybe not the same ethical rules apply here, because the plants don't feel any pain. So these are some of the questions that you can or should ask yourself before doing any type of experiment. Okay, I'm getting a little bit off the track now. I have to comment on this here. It's not related now to the content here. We're worried here about the well-being of insects, okay? And I think that's important, and it is right to question whether certain animal experiments, especially if they're not absolutely necessary, like for example in educational, in schools, whether they should be done, okay? On the other hand, I'll be very honest with you, I had some personal problems when I read this here in the book, because I know that there are so many human rights violations in the world, okay? And we are worried about the well-being of insects. Please get me right here. I'm not saying that you should not worry about the animal well-being of insects, but what I'm saying is just because you stick to certain ethical principles and animal right issues when doing experiments, this does not mean that you or that we can feel good about ourselves and say, okay, I've done all that. I'm feeling morally right now because I'm not doing any animal experiments. I'm even a vegetarian. I don't eat meat. Okay, all these things. Okay, it's all good and fine. Okay. But just let's not forget that at the center of everything is the human being, okay? And we should not simply by the fact that we're sticking to these ethical rules concerning animals, should not feel, be careful that we don't feel content about ourselves now and then say, okay, we've done now everything that is morally necessary and I can feel morally good about myself and I don't have to worry about the human rights issues now because I'm already morally superior, kind of, yeah? I'm just saying that this is something, an issue that I kind of, I'm not saying that you're feeling like this, I'm just saying that something we've got to be a little bit careful here, okay? Education and animal experiments and everything, all these things are not done for their pure fun, but because they are done because we place humans in the center. And the education that we have over here is so that we can actually help us humans and humankind, okay? And so we have to make a weigh it off very carefully whether certain animal experiments are indeed necessary. Many of them are not necessary, okay? But on the other hand, let's not feel too good about ourselves and say, okay, only because we stick to these ethical issues concerning insects, now I'm a more kind of morally superior and I don't have to worry about all the other human rights issues that occur in the world. Forget about it, okay? Just said it. analysis from data from respirometer experiments. Okay, let's just move on. I'm going to debate ethical issues more in my TOK in my TOK podcast. This here is a more general thing about statistics. First of all, number one, calculating mean results, you should calculate averages. You can only calculate averages if you repeat your experiment. Okay, why is this important to repeat the experiment? Because it tells you something about the quality of your average. And the quality of the average is determined by the so-called range bars in number two, or also known as standard deviation bars or error bars. And sometimes you can also plot the highest and the lowest one, okay? And you have the mean in the middle over here, right? Then you could, number three, you describe a trend, and you can see that the change over time, it says your days after start of soaking, this change over time is significantly higher than the error bars, okay? And therefore, this trend is significant. Always ask yourself, is the trend larger than the mistakes, than the errors, okay? And then at the end, you evaluate the data, and then you basically talk about the quality of the data, and you talk about the whether the trend really is significant or not, okay? So that is simply a general thing. I would say in the diagram on page 33 over here on the right side, they connected the means. I would not connect them. I would draw a line of best fit. As a matter of fact, I would have taken points off for this one over here because the student does not show an awareness of measurement error. Yeah, of course, the student did include the error bars. So you can say there is some awareness of measurement error, okay? But generally, you draw a line of best fit, okay? A trend line, and you simply do not connect the dots, okay? Next one, page 34, photosynthesis. Ah, yeah, so introducing photosynthesis. And over here, we have a formula in the top box, introducing photosynthesis. First of all, what is photosynthesis? It is the production of carbon compounds, organic material, organic substances, glucose, okay, in cells, in plant cells, okay, using light energy, okay? Plants do that. Certain photosynthetic bacteria as well, okay? There is a formula here, carbon dioxide and water and light energy gives you glucose and oxygen. This formula looks reversed from the cell respiration formula in which we take oxygen and glucose to produce water, carbon dioxide, and we release energy. So that's cell respiration. And this one over here looks the other way around. The box mentions that there are these stages in photosynthesis. I mean, that's right, but I actually think there are two main stages here. It says your carbon dioxide is converted to carbohydrates and other carbon compounds. Energy is needed to do this. That's not a stage, that's photosynthesis. Okay, so I don't get it why they're mentioning this as a stage. Energy is obtained from light, okay? And the energy, the light is absorbed by photosynthetic pigments, okay? That is also right, but that's also nothing more than essentially a description of what photosynthesis is. So what I'm going to do is I'm just going to tell you the two main stages of photosynthesis. It goes a little bit beyond that what you've got in the book. The first stage is called the light-dependent reaction. Okay, the light-dependent reaction is the first stage, and in the light-dependent reaction, we need, of course, light, and we need water. And so what you can do is, if you see the formula of photosynthesis at the top, you can make a check mark next to light energy, and you can make a check mark next to water. So we've taken care of these two things here. And in the light-dependent reaction, the light from the sun is used to do photolysis. And photolysis means that the water is split into oxygen and into electrons and hydrogen. Oxygen, hydrogen, and electrons. So the water is split up. And this oxygen is now released from the light-dependent reaction. So you can draw from the light-dependent reaction, you can say oxygen, an arrow out, yeah, and oxygen is released, and you can make a check mark next to oxygen, okay? And we're finished with the light-dependent reaction. So in the light-dependent reaction, we put light and water in, and what do we get out? We get out oxygen, electrons, and hydrogen. And this process is known as photolysis. Photolysis means the splitting of water using light. And the electrons that we get out, they contain now the energy, okay? And these electrons now go to the light-independent reaction. And in the light-independent reaction, the energy of the electrons and carbon dioxide and the hydrogens are used to make glucose. So you can draw carbon dioxide, electrons, and hydrogen, and you can draw an arrow. You can, this goes together to make glucose. Okay, that is the light independent. These are the two main stages. Okay, and I'm telling you this because the higher level people, they have to know these two stages, but it's not really explained here. But if I explain it to you in these two stages, then also it's also correct for the standard level people. Okay. And that's kind of the idea here. So okay, photosynthesis is the conversion or the production of carbon compounds from CO2 using light energy, and it has two stages, the light dependent reaction and the light independent reaction. In the light dependent reaction, light energy is used to split water, so we need water to make oxygen gas, that's the waste product, electrons and hydrogen, and the electrons and hydrogen are then taken, combined with the carbon dioxide, to make glucose. Okay, that is essentially all of photosynthesis in a summary, right? So photosynthesis and the atmosphere, that's the next box over here, page 34 on the right side. And we're now going back into time, a couple of million years back, or billion years back, when first bacteria started to produce oxygen, photosynthetic bacteria. It was like this, that at the very early Earth did not have any oxygen, okay? So it was an anaerobic environment, and the organisms, the bacteria that lived there, were anaerobic, okay? And they did anaerobic cell respiration, and there was no oxygen around, okay? Then some of the bacteria, they discovered, the photosynthetic bacteria, how to use light energy and water to make their own food, and they produced oxygen as a waste product. And this oxygen reacted with the materials, with the iron in the atmosphere, in the water, okay? And this oxygen formed iron oxide. And this iron oxide, that's rust essentially, okay? That settled down on the ground in the water, okay? It kind of precipitated out and collected on the ocean floor to form these so-called banded iron formations in the rock. So that means there are certain rocks that contain this red layer of iron oxide, which comes from the time when oxygen was first produced. So the first cells, they made oxygen, not the first cells, the first photosynthetic cells that produced oxygen, they made the oxygen, but this oxygen did not build up in the atmosphere yet, okay? Because it kind of reacted away to form these banded iron formations, okay? And only after all of this iron has been removed from the environment, only then oxygen started to increase in the atmosphere. Okay, so that's the oxygen that we have right now in our atmosphere. Is also from this first appearance of these photosynthetic organisms that produce the oxygen. And as a side product, as an interesting one, is this oxygen was poisonous for most organisms. Oxygen is very reactive. So as a matter of fact, many or most of the bacteria of the organisms at that time, they died out because the oxygen poisoned them. And then some of them, they discovered aerobic cell respiration. They said, actually oxygen can be quite useful, because if we use oxygen, then we can get more ATP out, okay? So some of them had an advantage then, an evolutionary advantage, because they knew how to use the oxygen to make aerobic cell respiration. Okay, so that's basically the whole issue with the banded iron formations, is when oxygen first appeared on Earth, it did not build up in the atmosphere. It first reacted with the substances in the iron, okay, to make these banded iron formations. And after this has been done, then it started to build up in the atmosphere. So page 34, absorption spectra on the left side. Chlorophyll A and B, there are two types of chlorophyll. Chlorophyll is the main photosynthetic pigment in plants. And chlorophyll, there are the two types A and B, they absorb different colors at different levels, amounts. So very briefly, if you have the diagram over here, it says here wavelength of light in nanometers. What I want you to do is at around 650 to 700 nanometers, I want you to write down red light. At around 400 to 450 nanometers, I want you to write down blue light. So you label the x-axis. So 400 to 450, that's blue light. And 650 to 700, that's the red light. And in between, at around 550, that's where we have the green light. Okay? And what you see is that chlorophyll A and B, they absorb a lot in the red and in the blue part of the spectrum, but they do not absorb very well in the green part. Why is that? I mean, that's why plants are green, right? Leaves are green because they don't make use of the green color and they send it back. And that's why we see plants being green, because it's not absorbed. It's kind of reflected, yeah? Because they don't use it. The question is why are plants not using the green color so much or in chlorophyll? And the reason is that the sunlight does not contain a lot of green color anyway. So the plants are saying, so there's actually no point in using it. If the sun does not give me a lot of green color, why should I bother to use it? It's not worth it, right? It's better for me to concentrate on the blue and the red part, because that's where I get much more from that, right? So that is kind of explains the idea here, okay? So the next one, action spectrum on the right side is which color of the light is used by photosynthesis most? Not surprisingly, well, of course, red and blue. I mean, that's what we're absorbing by chlorophyll, right? So essentially the diagram on the right side over here is pretty much almost the same one as the one on the left side with the absorption spectrum of chlorophyll, because that's what we're using for photosynthesis when we're absorbing it. However, there's a small difference here. And if you look at 500, 550, you see that it's not completely zero. It is using green light a little bit for photosynthesis. Now, how can this be? How can it be that the plant, even though chlorophyll doesn't absorb anything, in green, that we over here in the action spectrum we're using around, I don't know, in the green 20% around, that's this, yeah, of the light is used for of the green light is used. How can this be? And chlorophyll doesn't really absorb it at all. And the reason is because it's not chlorophyll. There are so-called accessory pigments. They are also in a plant leaf. There is not only the green chlorophyll, which is the main photosynthetic pigment, but there are also called accessory pigments, which are orange and yellow, okay? The carotenoids and so on. These are accessory pigments which are also able to absorb a little bit in the green, okay? So kind of helping pigments, right? So this is the reason why there is a little bit of photosynthesis also happening in the green, yeah? That is kind of the idea here, right? But otherwise, the chlorophyll is the green one. That's the main photosynthetic pigment. That's it. Page 35. We move on. We're almost finished with the chapter. Almost, okay? I'm already talking half an hour again. Investigating limiting factors. I'm going to explain you what is a limiting factor, okay? The limiting factor is a so-called... There are many factors that influence photosynthesis. Light is important, carbon dioxide is important, temperature is important. But the one which is kind of determining the speed of a chemical reaction, that is referred to as this limiting factor. If we have enough light and if the temperature is right, but if we don't have enough CO2, then photosynthesis cannot take place. So CO2 concentration is the limiting factor. If we have a lot of CO2 present and very little light, then light is the limiting factor, okay? It depends always, the one that's kind of missing, that is the one that kind of limits the reaction. And we have temperature, light intensity, and carbon dioxide concentration. And if we want to determine the limiting factor, we got to make sure that we keep everything constant except the one that we're changing, okay? Yes, and this one limiting factor is called the independent variable. And I'm just going to explain you over here this diagram on the right side. This is what we have. We have some pond weed. And from the stem, we have bubbles of oxygen. So we are measuring right now the number of bubbles formed per minute. So we can count the bubbles. And this kind of tells us something about the photosynthesis. And the sodium hydrogen carbonate, that is our source of carbon dioxide. Okay, we have a thermometer to measure the temperature of the water. And we have a light source. Okay. And what we do is the following is in the table down here, we have a limiting factor temperature. It says here you place the pondweed in water with a thermostatically controlled water bath. Okay. It shouldn't be too hot. Of course, it should not be too cold. Suggested range is between 5 and 45 degrees centigrade. And we're changing the temperature. Okay. Or the light intensity. What we can do is we can change the light intensity by changing the distance of the light source from the beaker. And we can change the carbon dioxide concentration by changing the amount of sodium hydrogen carbonate that we're adding to it, okay? And so what we're doing is counting the bubbles of oxygen formed per minute, yeah? So that is kind of this experiment over here. And how is now the effect of light intensity, carbon dioxide concentration, and the effect of temperature, the bottom boxes? And it is like this, that at low light intensities, the photolysis cannot take place. And of course, photosynthesis is very low, so there are a few bubbles of oxygen formed. Okay, as we increase the light intensity, the photosynthesis goes up, but only up to a maximum point, and then it levels off. Okay, so that means some other, at high light intensity, something else becomes limiting. For example, the amount of CO2 available. Okay, what about CO2 concentration? Okay, and here it's important, at low CO2 concentrations, there is of course also lower photosynthesis. However, there is a certain critical amount of carbon dioxide that we need. And that's below 0.01% of carbon dioxide. There is no photosynthesis at all. So this the line will only start on the x-axis, shifted over a little bit to the right, okay? Because of the, and then it will go up as we increase the CO2 concentration, and then it too will level off. If you look at the enzyme activity curves on page 27, it says the effect of substrate concentration, the CO2 concentration curve for photosynthesis looks exactly the same, almost exactly the same, except that we're not starting at zero, but we're shifting the whole curve over a little bit to the right, okay? Because we need to have a small substrate concentration of CO2 present first before we can even have an enzyme activity, okay? The reason is because, of course, enzymes are relevant in photosynthesis. That's why, and CO2 is a substrate. Yeah? So, and if the CO2 concentrations are very high, pure CO2, I don't know, then something else becomes limiting. And the temperature is, again, very similar to, on page 27, the effect of temperature curve. At low temperature, there is a low photosynthesis up to an optimum point, and then it drops again very steeply, because if the plant is too high, you're boiling the plant, you're denaturing the enzymes. Okay, so that means, it says here, at temperatures above 30 degrees centigrade, the enzyme Rubisco is decreasingly effective. Okay, even though it has not been denatured. Yeah, so you see that temperature can also play a role here. Okay, so that is basically, these are the photosynthesis curves that you have to know. Page 36, chromatography. That's one of the required practicals. No, you know what? Let's have a look at the bottom box first, because it kind of fits in better, results of an investigation into limiting factors. So what you have over here is you have the light intensity on the x-axis and the rate of photosynthesis on the y-axis, like, I don't know, the number of bubbles of oxygen formed. And what you see over here is that at the dotted line and the dashed line, that means you see that there is over here a change in the height. A point X, point Y, and Z are at different points. So what you can see is at the same CO2 concentration of 0.15%, temperature has an effect. Okay, so this means that you can change the temperature and it goes up. If you increase the temperature, okay, it goes from Y to Z. But look at the other one, the one with the circles and the X's. Here you increase the temperature and there is no increase in photosynthesis. And the reason is because carbon dioxide concentration is limited. Making the temperature higher won't have an effect, because the level of CO2 is too low. So CO2 is limiting. Okay? So so that means, I don't know why they actually have a W point here. Yeah. That is kind of the, yeah. It is possible to deduce which of the limiting factors at the point marked W to Z on each curve. Yeah, that's what they mean here. The thing is the following. The curve, there is no increase in photosynthesis at a low CO2 level when we increase the temperature. Okay, it's at the same line. And this means that CO2 is limiting. And if the CO2 concentration is higher, 0.15%, then temperature can have an effect because CO2 is not limiting. Okay, so that is kind of the thing over here. And then we go into chromatography, the top one, which is an experiment. I highly advise you that you also have a look at a YouTube video maybe explaining the whole thing. But what is really important here is the calculation of the RF value. So first of all, we're extracting the pigment. It says here you grind, number we cut up the leaf, number two we grind it. We're adding a little bit of acetone actually. Acetone or alcohol would be fine. This extracts the chlorophyll. And then we're applying the whole thing on number six, we're making a green little dot on filter paper. Okay, and then we're putting the whole thing into solvent, that's number seven, and the solvent, the running solvent, is soaked up into the filter paper and will now separate the different pigments in the mixture. And those substances that are dissolved very well in the solvent, those will travel the furthest. Okay, so over here, you see that carotene of value 0.9 and RF value, that is traveled very high. That means it dissolves very well in the solvent and therefore is carried along much further, okay? Because the solvent soaks up into the paper. Yeah, so what are these values? Chlorophyll A 0.65, chlorophyll B 0.6, what is this? These are the so-called RF values, and you calculate it as follows. You can say that carotene with 0.9, that was transported 90% of the maximum height. So we're measuring out the centimeters of how far did the solvent go. So you have to see how far is the wet, how far is the paper wet, okay? And that is in centimeters. Yeah, that is the distance moved by the solvent. And then we also measure the distance moved by the spot. And then we divide it and we have an RMF value, which is between 0 and 1, okay? And the RF values, basic different pigments should have different RF values, of course, but these RF values allow you to compare the results. So if I do the experiment and I have carotene of the value of 0.9 and somebody else does the experiment, but they're leaving the strip of paper longer in the solvent so that it travels further up, okay? And you do the math, then you still should get a value of 0.9 for carotene, okay? Everything else being the same, of course. Yeah, so this allows us to compare a little bit the results, because absolute centimeters don't really tell us a lot, because the absolute centimeters depend very much on how long you wait and how long you allow the solvent to travel. But if you calculate an RF value, RF stands for retention factor, then you can compare the results better between different people, okay? So that is, just remember that the RF value is between 0 and 1. And you can imagine it's almost like a percentage. You don't say percent, okay? But if it helps you to imagine, it's kind of the percentage of how far did the pigment travel, okay? Travel up, okay? So that is, if you want to do something like this at home, very simple, honestly, it's a two-minute experiment. If you want to get the idea, because if you have not done the experiment, it's a required practical, but if you have not done it for whatever reason, it's a very simple one. What you do is you take a felt tip pen, a dark one, let's say dark blue or black, and you put on a piece of filter paper, or even toilet paper or tissue paper is fine, a small dot, and you put the paper into water. But of course, the dot should be outside of the water. You don't wash it off, okay? You just put the edge of the paper into water and you allow the water to soak in into the tissue. And then you can see as it's soaked in that the dot starts to travel. And then if the pen is made of different colors, then the ink of the pen is made of different colors, and you can see actually the colors separating. Honestly, it's a 1 minute or 2 minute experiment. Try it out, okay? And then you get the idea. And then you all understand what is meant with how far did the solvent, in this case the water, travel. Because then you can mark out the distance or measure out the distance between the dot, where you put the dot, and how far the water traveled. Okay? Take a piece of tissue paper, which is really absorbent, or filter paper, put a small dot of a pen on it, and hold the edge of the paper, filter paper, into the water, into a cup of water, and allow it to soak into the filter paper, and then you will see that it will actually move into the dot, and will separate the pigments of the dot. Okay, so this was page 36, and we're finished with a topic too. Okay, we're finished with molecular biology. Okay, wish you a nice day.